George Johnson.
Hello, John. Ah. Didn't know who was supposed to speak first.
I'm here, and you're there. I'm John Horgan, and you are...
George Johnson, here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where it's rather overcast and drizzly. It's rather nice, actually.
Yeah, it's kind of like that way here, too. It feels like fall. It was a little chilly this morning.
Yeah, yesterday was my, I think it was my first long sleeve shirt day since spring.
Yeah, I like this. Well, you know, I like the changing weathers. That's one of the wonderful things
too.
About where we live.
Seasons are good.
Yeah,
I don't think I'd like to live in Phoenix. Although even in southern Arizona, they do have seasons. They're just more subtle.
Yeah, we have real seasons here. So in a few
weeks, I know.
We're going to have
well,
this
explosion
snow, of
you know,
color
so.
And.
Yeah.
So anyway, I have to. I'm dying to tell you about something that happened to me recently.
Oh,
and,
something good, I hope.
I've even found a science angle to it.
Okay.
It was not so much good. It could have been very bad. Anyway, I'll just tell you. This happened on Saturday of Labor Day weekend. It was early morning, and I let my dog out, fed him on the deck, and then I'm making coffee, and he runs off into the woods and takes a crap. And so I'm inside in our kitchen, and we have these sliding glass doors that look out on our deck. And I glance out, and I see Merlin is back on the deck, and he's sort of pawing his face. He looks very distressed. Mm. And I look out, and I can see he's got these speckles all over his face. So I'm thinking, what
speckles?
The hell? Speckles.
Like
yeah, it's kind of yellow.
White speckles?
It looked kind of yellowish. And almost like he'd been splattered with mustard. And so I opened the sliding glass door, and immediately this smell just, I mean, it really was like a slap across the face. Really sulfurous, rotten egg, garlic, burning rubber. My eyes were actually watering because the smell was so intense. So I realized, of course, that Merlin had been sprayed by a skunk.
I was afraid it was going to be like mustard gas, and you were under attack by terrorists.
I'm telling you, this shit is like mustard gas. This stuff
is
nasty. You have not smelled skunk unless you've smelled it up close. So if you're driving by a dead skunk on the road,
it's nothing.
Yeah, that's almost smells
nothing
good.
Prepares you for it.
Yeah. Well, so then
it's just the worst.
So then I'm inside, and I'm thinking, shit, what am I going to do? Susie was still sleeping, and I was thinking I should probably wake her up because she's the animal expert. And then I'm still inside looking at Merlin. He obviously wants to come in, and I'm thinking, no way, I've got to wash him or something.
Oh,
and then suddenly,
no.
Out of the corner of my eye, I see this creature walking up the steps to the deck. And it's
the skunk.
And I remember seeing it and thinking, oh, my gosh, it's so cute. It was kind of, you know, skunks have that waddling gait, and it was really fluffy and had the dramatic markings.
They look really cool.
Yeah, they do. And it just kind of sort of waddled across the deck. And I remember I wasn't horrified. I was more just sort of surprised, like, what the hell?
Yeah.
And then Merlin also sort of glanced at it, and we were both, I think, just startled. And then suddenly, at the last second, it lunged and grappled with Merlin's rear leg and started biting him viciously. And so Merlin...
it didn't just spray because it was surprised. Then it came back and stalked your dog and attacked him.
Right.
And it's rabies, I bet.
So it's right next to me, and, you know, they're right outside the door, and this thing is noshing on Merlin's leg, and Merlin is howling in pain. And then he starts biting the thing on the back, and it lifts up its nasty face and started snapping at his snout. And at this point, I slid the door open and started kicking the thing. And so it started coming. It fell off Merlin's leg, and then it lunged at me. And it's trying to snap at my ankles, and I didn't have any. I had shorts on, and Merlin, meanwhile, he goes darting into the house, and then
the
skunk is right behind Merlin, and I slam the sliding glass door shut, and just caught the skunk.
Caught the skunk
on his neck, and then I'm like slamming the door on the skunk's head. and it's looking up at me like it was just making it matter. It was looking at me like, I'm gonna get you. And then I finally shoved it out, and it's like, and by this time it was squirting. It was squirting this spray all over all over the deck. So then I'm thinking, what the hell do I do now? So I ended up running into the garage. I thought, I'll get a shovel or something. And then I saw a pitchfork. And so I grabbed this pitchfork, and I went out in the deck, and this thing is still lunging at me, and it keeps turning around, and it was spraying these jets of this yellow goo that were just missing me. And I'm trying to stab the thing with the pitchfork, and then finally I got it. I sort of actually pinned it between two tines, and then I hurled it out into the lawn. And to make a long story short, I ended up finally killing the thing, although it took a really long time. Their skin is incredibly tough.
Did you stab
tough.
It to death with the pitchfork?
I actually sort of pinned it down with a pitchfork, and then I whacked it on the head with a shovel until it finally died.
Wow.
And it was, the whole thing was so freaky. I mean, we live like an hour from New York City.
Yeah.
So we
have skunks all the time, but they've never attacked.
Well, we have skunks around here. I've seen them before, but they're very shy and unaggressive. They just kind of go waddling off when they see you. They don't want to mess with anybody.
Pretty brazen skunks, actually, in our backyard. I mean, we're kind of on the edge of town, and we got on the skunk circuit for about 5 years, and they would come out of an arroyo that was about half a block away, and they'd come out of the mountains at night and come foraging in our yard. And for a while they colonized the shed that we had in back, and the mother skunk brought in her baby skunks into the shed.
And
then
they're
got
really
locked
cute.
In there because I didn't know they were in there, and then the mother skunk was desperately trying to claw into the shed to get her babies, and then the babies actually dug a huge hole through the wall to
yeah,
try
they're
to
real,
escape.
They're very good diggers. They're always trying to dig into Susie's
bird
cage.
Yeah, so they're pretty aggressive. And I used to actually, they'd come to the back door and they would stare in because they wanted the cat food.
Yeah.
So I would sneak around the back and then I would throw rocks at them.
But they're not aggressive.
And they would just look at me like, yeah, what? They weren't scared at all. But,
right.
You know, if one had ever lunged at me and grabbed my leg and started chewing at it, that's horrifying.
Merlin is a 120-pound dog, so this thing had sprayed him, and Merlin ran away. And then the crazy thing was that it stalked him. It went after
Well, did the skunk have rabies?
Yes, it did have rabies. I mean, I knew it had rabies before we had it tested.
Because rabies is a central nervous system infection, right?
Yeah, so then I spent the rest of the afternoon, I mean, we called the animal control people, and we got some information from them, and then I went on the internet. So one of the things I was worried about was whether you can get rabies from skunk spray. And there are
no
recorded,
it's a virus, so why not?
Yeah, I wanted to be sure. So it actually, rabies is transmitted primarily by saliva, so it's actually a really interesting virus. It normally, here's the science. You get it through, it's one of the oldest known, one of the first diseases to be described. It's been known for at least 4,000 years ago. And Louis Pasteur developed the first vaccine in the late 1880s. So he found that you could use a serum from infected rabbits and give this to people who had just been exposed, and they would develop antibodies that would protect them from getting the full-blown disease. Because there's just,
so he was actually using the rabies virus itself?
They're attenuated or killed rabies viruses, so they're obviously not full blown.
It's kind of the sympathetic magic school of immunology.
Yeah, and it's been very effective. It's been very effective at wiping out rabies among humans in the developed world, but there's still about 55,000 people who die of rabies around the world.
Wow,
and it's really a horrible disease. So you get you get infected through a wound, and then the virus makes its way, gets into the nervous system, and then travels to the brain, and that can take anywhere from a couple of weeks. If you get bitten in the face, it can get to your brain quite quickly, as opposed to the extremities. But it can take even a year. So some people don't realize that they have the virus in them, and then suddenly they develop the symptoms. And at that point, the virus really hijacks your brain, and then it's amazing if you think about it. It hijacks the parts of the brain that are involved in aggression, and basically turns you into this hyper aggressive, vicious zombie that just wants to bite other things, and that's how the virus is transmitted. So I actually found this wonderful article by Robert Sapolsky. You know, he's this great biologist at Stanford, who's done a lot of work on aggression and testosterone and so forth. This is this is an article in Scientific American on lessons we can learn from microorganisms and parasites. And he says of rabies virus that this virus knows more about the neurobiology of aggression than the smartest scientists in the world. It somehow figures out how to transform its host's brain in such a way that the host becomes a rabies-transmitting machine for about 5 or 6 days until the animal becomes paralyzed and dies.
Wow, God, that's a great description.
So it's really this interesting strategy for transmission, and in spite of these vaccines and all we know about rabies, it's turned out to be incredibly difficult to eradicate. So rabies is actually bouncing back, I'm sure you know this, in North America in a big way. So cases among humans are extremely rare. They're really only 2 or 3 a year over the last 20 years or so. And those are usually from people who've been bitten by a bat, and the bite is so tiny that they don't even realize that they've been bitten. So it might just be
I knew bats were a major carrier, but I didn't realize you could get bit. I thought you just died in a few days if it wasn't treated. That's amazing. So it basically hijacks your brain, as you put it. So it's like using your brain as a vector, but in this really sophisticated kind of indirect way where it drives you into wanting to bite people.
Yeah.
Does the word rabies come from the same root as like rage or...
I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
There's been one case in recorded history of someone surviving rabies after developing the symptoms. So as I said, there's this latency period, but then you start getting really agitated and you develop these movement problems and you become enraged eventually. And at that point, you are doomed. Except in this one case where a girl in Wisconsin was bitten by a bat, and she didn't even realize it. She had caught this bat in her church and had set it free, and then she started developing these strange symptoms a couple of months later, and she was misdiagnosed at first, and suddenly her doctors realized that she had rabies, and they administered they put her into a coma with, among other drugs, ketamine, which is a very powerful anesthetic. Pardon me?
That's one of your favorites, right?
Yeah, well, I've never tried it, but it is a very popular hallucinogenic drug. It knocks you out at a certain dose, but at slightly lower doses, you have an out-of-body experience, and it really messes you up in a big way.
I met some anesthesiologists at this consciousness conference that were totally into ketamine.
Yeah, this was John Lilly, the great neuroscientist who was the... one of the models for the movie Altered States. He was
LSD whale man.
LSD and ketamine. But anyway, there's another article in Scientific American that I found that just came out last year. It was written by one of the doctors who treated this girl, and they basically put her into a coma, and then they could treat her with all these antiviral medicines, and her brain wasn't swelling, getting inflamed in the way that it would have if she hadn't been put into a coma. Yeah. And she eventually came out of it, and now she's fine. So this treatment has been, you know, was successful in her case. It's been, there have been other teams that have tried to replicate it in other rabies cases, mostly outside of the country, and it hasn't worked anywhere else.
Well, were they using, like, antivirals, or?
Yeah, so amantadine was one of the other drugs that they used, which is an antiviral. But the key was putting her in this coma.
Yeah.
So, anyway, it's just a fascinating disease.
Yeah.
One reason why I was a little worried about getting rabies through skunk spray is that there have been some reports of spelunkers, cave divers, getting rabies from breathing in particles of... Yeah.
Wow. Well, you know, the two things I remember most about rabies when I was growing up in Albuquerque, where there were a lot of kind of wild dogs, because they didn't really have a functioning animal control department. And,
yeah.
And we were warned, one, if you see a dog that's foaming at the mouth, that this means it has rabies. But it sounds like that's the least of it.
Well, you know, even the foaming at the mouth symptom is, you know, it's another... it's another example of how clever this virus is. So, you know, that it's transmitted by saliva. And
oh,
so,
and it bites, but, and that is copiously spitting.
And you can't swallow. So the reason why, you know, one of the rabies was sometimes called hydrophobia because your throat would convulse and you couldn't swallow. And humans who had rabies, they would become panic-stricken even at the sight of water because they would be fearful that they'd choke. And I guess some rabies victims, people would try to give them water to try to get rid of all the saliva and foam collecting in their mouth. Yeah. So this symptom ensures that the mouth will have plenty of saliva in it when the rabies victim is... the rabies zombie is trying to bite someone else.
Wow. It's amazing it hasn't taken over the world.
Actually,
that's so well adapted. But, you know, the other thing I remember about rabies growing up is they'd always say on the 10 o'clock news, they'd say that, sixth grader was walking home from school and got bit by a dog and the dog ran away, and they'd give a description of the dog, and they'd say, please call if you know where we can locate this animal because so it can be isolated and we can see if it has rabies. And then they'd say, because otherwise Johnny will have to undergo a painful series of stomach injections.
Yeah.
You know, what was that about?
Yeah, that's how the vaccine used to be administered. I'm not sure why it had to be injected into the stomach. It's not done that way.
Mainline it into your brain at that point.
Yeah, it's not done that way anymore. So Susie ended up getting shots just a few days ago for rabies because she was, after she got up, she checked Merlin's leg by running her hands up and down it to see if there was any blood and to see if he, you know, felt any pain when she was feeling it. And so... she was persuaded by some of the people we spoke to after this had happened that she could be exposed. Even if there was a microscopic cut in her hand, the virus could get in that way. And actually, some of these same people thought that if I had any sense in me, I would get the shots too. But I decided to, because of my anti-medicine bias.
Yeah, I was thinking that would be inconsistent for you to err on the side of caution.
So I told Susie,
I'd go with Susie on that one, but it wasn't the classic painful series of stomach injections.
No, it was. I think you still need a series of them. Mm. So she got it. I think it was in her arm, and she said it was it hurt, but it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't this giant shot in the stomach that they used to give.
Yeah,
but
I
told Susie
God, what
that
a horrible experience.
Oh, but it was it was. It was cool too.
Well,
I felt
it's giving you a lot of great material,
and I felt
you didn't get rabies, so that's the best part, and your dog didn't. But I know about the smell. I mean, you think it's bad when you encounter it at a slight distance, but it happened to me once when I was very young, and my parents our family still has this cabin up in the mountains near Los Alamos.
Yeah.
And we were inside the cabin one night playing cards or some dumb dice game called Yahtzee that we used to play.
Oh, I used to play that.
And then suddenly we heard our dog yelling and running, and fortunately the back door was closed, so it ran under our back porch. I always thought it was chasing a skunk under the porch, but now that you describe your experience, I'm thinking maybe the skunk was chasing the dog. But anyway, the collision came under the porch and it sprayed, and it was just the most horrible, nauseating, just unbelievably debilitating thing I've ever smelled.
Oh no! How did you? And there's no way to get rid of that, right?
Well, our neighbors down the hill, there's this guy down the hill named Doc Bell, and he wasn't a doctor, but he knew all about skunks, so they came up the next day, and they said, well, first you have to bathe your dog in tomato juice.
Yeah, that's the old remedy.
And you have to burn cornmeal in an iron skillet.
Huh?
Come to think of it, they were actually playing cards with us that night, so they brought out all these folksy remedies. So my mother was walking around with an iron skillet scorching cornmeal in it, or for some reason, or cornstarch or something.
Yeah.
And then we were bathing the dog in big cans of tomato juice, like V8. I don't know if any of that actually did any good. But
Susie found some remedy that involved hydrogen peroxide and white vinegar and all this other stuff. We used that to... It turned out Merlin wasn't... For some reason, he didn't really... we just washed him with soap and water that morning. And I guess because we did it so quickly, it...
Really?
He doesn't smell at all. But our deck...
Oh, that's good.
Our deck...
So your house isn't like... I mean, our cabin was just kind of, disgustingly skunky smelling for weeks, as I recall.
Well, I can
and we left and then came back.
I still think what would have happened if that damn skunk had gotten inside, if I hadn't just at the last second slammed the...
I think it would have gone for your leg next.
The door. Well, but then it would have been running around spraying inside the house.
God, you would have had to burn the house.
I think we would have.
Build
just,
a new one.
Do you have any idea
what chemicals in skunk spray? What chemicals?
Yeah, I actually looked that up. The skunk
I
itself
figured
you is...
probably had.
The skunk itself is a pretty... fascinating example of the ingenuity or creativity of natural selection. So rabies is kind of the evil side of natural selection. The skunk is more, it's got a defensive mechanism for keeping other creatures from messing with it. It contains methyl and butyl thiols, which are really stinky. They're sulfur-based chemicals. Skunks rarely spray each other, so they will fight each other, but just with tooth and claw. And every now and then, two male skunks fighting over a female, it's typical, will spray each other. But generally, they don't.
You wouldn't think they'd care. You might smell good to them.
The major predator of skunks are horned owls. Because they can barely smell at all, so they don't care about skunk spray.
That's interesting. They just swoop down and get them.
Yeah.
And we need more horned owls.
I found looking for googling skunks in New Mexico. There is something called the Dragoo Institute for the Betterment of Skunks and Skunk Reputations, which tries to put out positive information on skunks.
Wow. Boy, that's a uphill battle. It's in New Mexico.
Yeah, I think so. It was a little ambiguous.
Did you say Dragoon? Dragoon?
Dragoo. Dragoo.
Oh, Dragoo.
Dragoo.
Oh.
And, even skunks' markings are... So one of the strategies of certain animals is to have some kind of toxic response that keeps other creatures from messing with them, and often they have very bright markings because they don't want to use this defense if they don't have to. I mean, skunks have a limited amount of spray.
Yeah, just from my observations of the skunks that used to hang out in our yard, it seems like they really would avoid spraying if they can. So it seems like it must have been very costly, energy, as far as their energy or something or.
Well, when this thing was spraying me, it was this really focused jet that was going 10-15 feet in the air. I mean, it was...
What did, like, aim it?
It was...
like a water
gun. At one point, this thing was in front of me, and it was wriggling around its butt as I was dancing back and forth, trying to get me in its sights and squirt me.
Yeah, you can't startle them. They would come up to our glass door and just look in, and I would... you know, go kick the door to try to get them to run away, and they would just look at me. But they never sprayed. You know, sometimes we'd smell them when they sprayed, you know, maybe, you know, across the yard or something like that, and we'd have to close all the windows. And
yeah.
That was pretty bad, but, oh, nothing like getting it right and practically in the face.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right, so I've milked that. Oh, I have one more. I just got one more.
No, this is good. This is really good. Skunks' experiences are one of those kind of human things that, you know,
they're great.
Lead to
good
conversations.
Yeah, I'm sort of glad that nature can bite back now and then.
Yeah.
You know, so I told Susie I didn't get the injections, but I said that if I start drooling and snapping at her and the children, that she should feel free to have me euthanized. And so she kind of looked at me and she said, "Where'd you put that pitchfork?"
I'm just imagining you coming home from work one day and then you're kind of in a bad mood and Susie says something and then you kind of lunge her a leg and start gnawing on it. And, yeah.
Well, that just happened. That happened before this whole rabies exposure.
Oh, so that, yeah.
So that's, you know, it's going to have to be something more dramatic than that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, all right. So what else we got here?
They started up the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Geneva, and did the first, you know, sent the beams around the track each way last week, and I guess celebrated with champagne. And so the biggest particle accelerator in the world is up online, and so far no black holes have, you know, sucked the universe into them. So, so far so good.
Come on, tell me honestly, are you really excited?
A little bit, yeah, more than I thought I would be. And, just because of the mystery, just, you know, you don't know, something really cool and new might come out of this. And partly, did you see the article that your former colleague Jim Weatherall had in Slate this week?
No.
Oh, it was good. It was about the Higgs boson. And, and, you know, basically what they're saying about this, about the LHC, is the one thing, you know, like they take poles and things, and the physicists say the one thing we're just almost sure that we're going to find at this energy level is the Higgs boson.
Yeah.
And the Higgs boson is, just to back up, is this particle that sort of interacts with all the other particles, you know, protons, neutrons, etc., and gives them the particular masses they have. Or I guess some people think of like the Higgs field, you know, in every field in quantum mechanics is associated with a particle. So the Higgs field is kind of like this, if you imagine this viscous kind of abstract mathematical field, and then the particles are going through it, and it creates a different drag on different particles, and that's what gives them their mass or their inertia, you know, and slows them down. And so they have to find this particle to show that there really is this Higgs thing, and then supposedly, hopefully, they might be able to go on and expand the standard model, which describes all of the particles, to include why they have the particular masses they have. Because now it's a mystery. You know, for some reason, the proton and the neutron are almost exactly, but not quite, the same mass.
Yeah.
And of course, the electron's vastly lighter, and the Higgs would kind of explain that, but the thing that Jim Weatherall's article pointed out, which, you know, was basically, you know, they had to invent the Higgs to explain why these other particles in the standard model, like the ones that carry the weak force, for example, and the strong force, you know, these force-carrying particles, why they're so massive. And the reason they know they're massive and have to be massive is because they haven't found them in the accelerators. So, you know, there's been kind of this trajectory in particle physics for the last few decades where you come up with these theories, and the theories always require extra particles that you don't have on hand, and then you look for them in your particle accelerators, and then if you can't find them, you say, oh, well, this just proves they must be more massive than we thought, and we can't create them at these energies, so we have to build a bigger collider.
Yeah. So. Well, that sounded like kind of a cynical wrap-up to what I thought.
Well, you thought I was going to say something inspiring about... Well, no, actually, an interesting irony struck me as like with the Higgs, for example, they couldn't find the Higgs, you know, at the Tevatron, the big accelerator at Fermilab, because, you know, and then they say, well, it shows that the... You know, they, if they don't find it, they can declare a success and say, well, this shows that we've set a floor on the mass of the Higgs boson. It has to be heavier than so many, many electron volts. And so then, you know, they go to the LHC and look for it. But the thing that's interesting is the reason that they don't know the mass of the Higgs boson and can just, you know, keep pushing it up the scale if they don't find it is because they haven't discovered the Higgs boson, which would be able to, you know, once they had that, they could predict masses.
Yeah.
So, it's, yeah, I'm kind of saying it in a roundabout way. But if they had a Higgs boson and a theory that explained why the particles had the masses that they had, if they predicted a new particle, they'd say it has to be within this mass range. And then if they don't find it, it would falsify the theory.
Oh, I would,
but
it would,
they don't
it would,
find the Higgs, so they keep saying, well, the Higgs has to be heavier and heavier, and there's no way to put any constraints on it because they
see.
Don't
so,
have the Higgs. So.
So once we have the Higgs, it would narrow the range possible masses for a lot of these
yeah.
particles that they've looked for over the decades.
Yeah, important so constraint.
I wonder if that would constrain... Well, let me just sort of back up and talk about, you know, my reaction to this search for the Higgs. It seems to me that it will be... It can't help but be anticlimactic that, you know, it's such... They've been talking about it so long, it seems like almost a foregone conclusion that they'll find
yeah.
the Higgs. I mean, if they don't find it, I suppose... Unless they say, "Oh well, then it's just at a higher energy range," then that could be the most exciting and rejuvenating possibility for particle physics. But I mean, you know, if they find it, it just sort of completes the standard model. It doesn't say anything about these larger issues that have really defined physics over the last 20 or 30 years.
Right.
Having to do with the reconciliation of quantum mechanics and relativity, the search for a true unified theory. You can't say a grand
right.
unified theory, because a grand unified theory is only unification of electromagnetism and the nuclear
yeah.
forces. So real unification is beyond grand unification. That's the theory of everything. That's string
right.
theory or loop space theory and all these other exotic theories. And the, you know, the honest reporting on the LHC points out that it won't come close to really giving hard data on strings and loop space theory and some of these.
Yeah, that
these
seems
other
to be pretty much accepted. But you know, the exciting thing is what it might find that no one expects. And
right.
You know, and actually, Jim Weatherall sort of made this point in the first piece he did for Slate, which I think, you know, you were very instrumental in. And getting Slate to know about him and publish it.
Yeah, that was last spring.
Last spring, yeah. And in that article, he was basically saying that, you know, if they do find the Higgs, you know, that would be this big disappointment. But I think, I mean, I guess his point was if they do find the Higgs and they don't find anything else, yeah, that's just going to kind of complete the standard model, which is still kind of a hodgepodge, really, of different theories that are sort of cobbled together. You know, and one of the means of, you know, cobbling them is the Higgs boson, because it explains these seemingly arbitrary masses. But what he pointed out in this new article that I hadn't thought of was, you know, they came up with this idea. Well, they knew they needed some kind of mechanism to explain the masses, mm-hmm. and also to explain what they call symmetry breaking, which is a closely related idea. Like the standard model, if you distilled it to its purest form, you would basically just have photons as the only kind of energy carrier, these massless, you know, perfect particles that go at the ultimate speed, the speed of light, and all energy would be in the form of photons in this perfectly symmetric model. And then you can, you know, metaphorically, you can go back and say at the beginning of the universe, right at the Big Bang, this is what existed, this one pure, pure force.
And let there be light.
The symmetries broke, and then some of the electrons got dragged down by the Higgs field and became these weak force carriers with these weirdly large masses, and you know, everything kind of got messed up in the sort of Gnostic way, like, you know, pure spirit descending to Earth and getting trapped and dragged down in ugly matter. And they needed some way to explain that, and the Higgs mechanism was the one that really caught on, and I'm sure there's good reasons that it did, but what Jim was pointing out, if I may call him Jim,
sure.
I've never met him.
Jim Weatherall, who used to work with me at Stevens Institute.
Right, so you know him. So.
Yeah.
But there's this other model I call Technicolor, where it's just another mechanism that wouldn't require the Higgs, but it would require other particles that would explain where the masses come from. So I guess it's possible if they don't find the Higgs, instead of just kind of kicking it upstairs and saying, well, this is going to take a much larger accelerator than the LHC, which will probably never be built in our lifetimes, that they'll say, well, maybe we should drag out this Technicolor model again and dust it off and look at that. And
well, that might show Jim's training at Harvard, because I think there was a big Technicolor group. I think Howard George was a Technicolor guy, and Steve Weinberg, while he was at Harvard, I think worked on Technicolor.
Shelley Glashow,
and so maybe there was still some residue of fondness for Technicolor at Harvard while Jim was getting a master's in physics there.
Yeah, and there may be really good reasons. I mean, there's probably more than just. I think Jim's argument was that it's mostly just historical reasons why the Higgs became the particle that they're looking for. The Higgs mechanism became the one that became entrenched as what was going to explain the masses of the Standard Model, and that it could have just as easily been another mechanism, but I wonder if it seems like there must be some compelling reasons that scientists have preferred the Higgs over the Technicolor model. But I don't know what they are.
May I just ask a kind of cosmic metaphysical question that's related to this? All right.
Yeah.
It's really sort of a question having to do with sociology of science. So I've been thinking about the question of when you pull the plug on a project, when you say that a particular goal is not worth pursuing anymore or not worth even waiting for, and when you can even mock those who still cling to this goal. So
well,
for example, so
never
I think,
say die.
Well, there are religious prophecies that have been made of, coming of the Messiah and so forth. And I think it's fair at this point in history to say that we don't need to take that seriously anymore, and we can even make fun of people who still believe in the coming of the Messiah.
Yeah, you mean like you'll have the fundamentalists who will do all these complex calculations from Bible verses and like there were the Millerites there's been groups every few years, and they come up with these exact calculations that show when the end times are coming, and they have to do with news events and things in the Middle East the mark of the beast and stuff like this. But they come up with these very precise calculations, and then they all gather on a hilltop, like
you
saw a Simpsons episode like that the other night, and then nothing happens, and then they say, well, actually we were supposed to multiply by pi or something. And then it goes on, and they wait another 10 years, and then they keep tweaking the theory. So you're saying that maybe this is what's happening with particle physics.
Yes, you anticipated my argument. I'm saying, at what point do we put the search for, not for the Higgs boson or evidence of Technicolor, those are pretty I could see those. I think those should be taken seriously. They're achievable. I just don't find them very exciting anymore. But what is exciting, would be very dramatic, is finding a true unified theory, a theory of everything, that maybe can give insight into why the universe was created in the first place and why it took this form, you know, that which is something that has been driving physics for quite a while, for decades now.
Yeah.
And
at what point
do you? And so you look at some of the unified theories now, strings, and it's, you know, associated with landscape theory, these, you know, parallel universe theories and all that. At what point? I mean, obviously, I've already reached the point where I think it's appropriate to mock certain versions of a certain so-called solutions to this problem. But should the entire enterprise be mocked? I guess is what I'm asking. Is it getting to the point where it's sort of like those predictions of the end time and the Messiah and so forth? I think it's getting pretty close.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, of course, the difference is that, the difference should be that there are constraints in predicting the existence of particles that don't apply to predicting the beginning of the end times. But you'd probably argue that those constraints have pretty much disappeared because, you know, there's been no suggestions of how you're going to test the predictions of string theory, even with the LHC.
Yeah, that would be my argument. And I think also you have to look at what the potential payoff from the theory is. So, you know, I was thinking about this in the context of the search for a cure for cancer. So we've had for decades now, you know, so the Nixon actually formally declared a war on cancer and started funneling huge amounts of money into research on cancer and treatments in 1971, I think it was. And we've had all these claims of enormous breakthroughs and a cure on the horizon or much better treatments and so forth. And all those hopes have been repeatedly dashed. But I would never say that we should give up the quest for a cure for cancer or mock people who are trying. I think we need to be very skeptical when scientists say they've found a cure or, you know, something that could become a cure very soon, given the track record of the field. But we would never give up on that quest entirely or you know, or say that it's not an honorable quest.
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, sometime, I think it was in the last week, very recently, the president of the British Association of Science, I probably don't have the title quite right, but I saw an article somewhere, I think on the BBC website, and he said basically what you're saying. I mean, it was, you know, everyone was all hyped up about the LHC starting up this week, and he was saying that, you know, it's time to really think. I mean, look how much money we've been pouring into this, and what have we gotten for it, and look at all the things that we really need to solve, like global warming and a malaria vaccine and things like this. And he made basically the same argument you did, and then there was a rebuttal a few days later by a physicist, and he was, his main point, as I recall it, was that when you look at how much money goes into high-energy physics and the LHC and its other manifestations, it's just trivial compared to the money that's spent, say, on the Iraq War, or the money that's spent, say, on bailing out the United States economy because a bunch of 35-year-olds on Wall Street crashed it with all these complex financial instruments.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a drop in the bucket.
That's a good point, except that I'm not sure if that is a fair comparison to, for example, military spending. I mean, I certainly agree that our military spending is horribly wasteful, and then the end result is so destructive often.
Yeah, well, I guess a better comparison would be how much money goes into the so-called war on cancer.
Yeah, or, as you said, malaria or AIDS or schizophrenia.
Yeah, but I don't think you can argue that money going into the LHC is money that otherwise would be going into medical research.
Well, I don't know.
You can do both.
I guess, you know, it is. It's just also just kind of an intellectual argument about what we, you know, what we will gain even if we do achieve this goal, and you know, you have to add to the calculation what the prospects look like right now, and what we can gain from further experimentation and so forth. And I think, you know, the whole package makes it look sort of less appealing, and it's more over on the side of just sort of things that you don't need to take that seriously anymore. Just one
yeah, but
more.
It's just such a wonderful manifestation of the whole human quest to understand the universe. And
I think I mean, there will always be, maybe, I'm sure, you know, there will always be people who are pursuing this, if only mathematically. I guess the question at some point becomes, are we going to put up money for the next gigantic accelerator, or will the field of theoretical physics, especially in pursuit of a unified theory, contract to a small group of sort of fringe figures who are pursuing the, you know, the iterations of string theory decades from now?
Yeah, well, that's a depressing thought.
It is kind
of
a depressing thought.
And it's something that a lot of the string people I talked to when I was out in Santa Barbara a couple of years ago, you know, what they were worried about. If they don't find something really new and exciting at the LHC, it's going to be politically impossible because of people like you to get money for the next big accelerator. But that's what makes it so exciting. I mean, there's no reason to think that they won't find some really interesting, unexpected things that require whole new theories to explain, and that maybe make them, you know, realize some basic flaw or contradiction at the root of string theory, and then, you know, that will overturn everything and start making sense. But you got to try.
Well, here, let me bring up one other example that that you've heard me discuss before on this show: the quest for an end to war. So, there are some intellectuals, and a couple of examples are Donald Kagan, who's an historian at Yale, who's written a lot about the origins of war, particularly in ancient Greece and elsewhere, and a guy named Victor David Hansen, who's also a classicist, who's written a lot about war. Both of them see war as and militarism as shapers of civilization and as often very positive forces in human history. And they also and in their writings they mock people who talk about the end of war. They say this is a total pipe dream.
Right, right.
And it's silly. It's not worth taking seriously. And I compare that, and I would say that war is more in the category of a cure for schizophrenia or a cure for cancer. We have repeatedly had predictions of the end of war. You know, right before World War I and right before World War II, and at the end of the Cold War, there were major intellectuals who said, maybe we can see the end of war now. And then those hopes are dashed. And then, you know, these fatalists like Kagan and Hansen come out and sneeringly say, see, look, it's futile to talk about the end of war. You just have to accept war and militarism as facts of life. And I see that as just the lowest kind of fatalism, and they even, you know, they mock people who say that we need to think about how to create a peaceful world.
Well, think about it in what sense? I mean, you're saying like a scientific solution, like some sort of vaccine that would counteract the natural rabies viruses we have that make us want to fight each other, or
good
tie back, sociological
George.
Studies, or I mean,
everything.
But the solutions will be political, right?
The solutions, I think we need to understand the problem, and I think science has a lot to contribute there. I think science, we can also try different methods in different regions. For example, you know, the reasons why war might break out in sub-Saharan Africa would be different, say, than war in the former Yugoslavia, or the war that just broke out between Georgia and Russia. And so they're different.
But isn't this stuff already being studied, like, under the guise of political science and geography? And
not as systematically as I think it deserves to be.
Yeah.
So actually, there's...
Well, this seems like a good... definitely a good thing to me, but, you know, it doesn't mean you can't do the LHC, too.
Okay, fair enough. I think it's an interesting question, though. When, you know, what goals? At what point?
No, you're right.
You know, there's this endeavor that keeps failing, and and hopes are dashed when you say enough is enough, there's no point to pursuing this anymore, as opposed to saying no, we have to keep trying.
But who's going to decide that? I mean, you know, unfortunately, the United States Congress already decided that years ago when they canceled the superconducting super collider, which had it been built would be bigger than the LHC is now and would have been doing all this interesting physics for the last decade or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people who decided were basically these ignorant, you know, congressmen who just thought, you know, well, why are we spending the taxpayers' money on this stuff, you know?
You know something? They weren't all that ignorant.
Have a new dam for, you know, my state. And, you know, but the scientists should be the ones who are going to decide this. You know, they're the experts on this. But then again, you know, there's the argument that Lee Smolin, the physicist, makes that they're kind of locked into this sort of self-reinforcing mindset called string theory, and that there's not any openings for other ideas really to compete. That if you're a young graduate student who, you know, doesn't really know all that much about physics, you're going to get sucked into string theory, and that's the only way you can make a career. And of course, the counter argument is, well, that's because string theory is the best thing we've got going here.
Well, remember, Phil Anderson, who's a Nobel Prize winner in squalid state physics, bitterly opposed the superconducting super collider because he thought it was taking resources away. You know, it is a zero-sum game to an extent when you're talking about research allocations, and he said it's taking the money away from other very valid and important research with practical and intellectual consequences.
That's right. I'd forgotten
In physics and other areas of research. And, you know, I actually talked to Jack Gibbons, who was a physicist who was Clinton's science advisor in the early 90s when the debate over the SSC was still going on. And he also was, you know, this was not an ignorant boob. This is a very sophisticated guy. He was very sympathetic toward particle physics, but it just came down to how much you can spend on one thing when there are all these other needs over here. Like even, you know, if you want to talk about space exploration, the Hubble Space Telescope, there's some other exciting things that can be done with that money, too, that are also in the realm of pure science, and you just have to make these tough decisions. So,
Who makes them? Congress, because they're the representatives of the people.
Yeah.
I mean, do we need like a... But, you know, there's the president's national science advisor, right?
Right.
I mean, can you even name this person?
Oh, yeah, I should know his name. Is it Bromley?
I don't know. The Bush administration didn't eliminate the position, I guess.
No, they didn't, although he has much less power, and he's basically been trying to justify his existence to all his colleagues over the last 8 years.
Yeah.
But he's actually been...
We need like a wise council of scientific elders.
Well, this guy apparently is a liberal Democrat, and somehow he has... I don't know how he's done his job. Chris Mooney wrote a lot about him in the Republican War on Science.
Yeah.
And how this guy has... I'm not sure if it is Bromley. Bromley might be a throwback to a previous administration. But anyway, I read about him. Bush does have these advisors, but it seems as though if they don't agree with Bush, they're just thrown out.
We need some power, like maybe science philosopher kings that can... No, I guess what I really think is that we just, you know, obviously need more money across the board for scientific research. And, you know, that's sort of like being in favor of apple pie and motherhood, but, you know, it's something that's been steadily eroded when it, you know, should be increasing every year, and you set that as a priority, and maybe other things have to suffer.
No universal health care, but we should build a $15 billion collider?
Well, you think we can get universal health care for $15 billion?
I don't know, but
pay $15 billion. I mean, again, the LHC is this... wonderful example of international collaboration with all these different countries, putting in some money. So it's not like we were taking on the burden of the theory of everything ourselves.
I would like to see it. I would love to see particle physics continue in spite of all the negative things I've been saying about it. Just for the pure thrill of exploration in the same way that I'd like to see, you know, I'd like to see a manned mission go to Mars. It's,
yeah,
that would be terrific. But but then in the meantime, I think it's fair to point out that we have some of these other problems that really affect people's well-being that are not being adequately funded.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's disputing that, but let's just hope they find something really cool.
Yeah.
And maybe it'd be this black hole, which would, you know, I guess you can't really have a limit to that, where you can just have a black hole that would, like, eat a huge hole in the Earth, you know, right under the LHC and swallow the whole thing, and tragically, along with some of the smartest people in the world, but then it would be contained so that we would learn from it. And
well, maybe they would be transported to a parallel world with insectoid aliens who have IQs of 7 million, and they can transmit their knowledge back to us through special hyperdimensional
radio tachyons. Devices. Yeah. Faster than light particles. And that they'll become these great wise rulers with all this power, and it'll be like the big robots in the day the Earth stood still. Down and enforce an end to war because they can vaporize the whole planet if we don't become peaceful.
That's what my students always talk about. That scenario is the only way war will end, is aliens coming down to the Earth.
Well, have you seen this movie? It's an old movie based on H.G. Wells' novel called The Shape of Things to Come.
Uh-huh.
I just recently downloaded that and watched it, either for the first time, or if I watched it before, it didn't set in my memory. But it's this great old black and white film, and it actually came out before World War II. And it's set in England, and they're having Christmas, and there's all these great, you know, folksy, warm feeling Christmas scenes, and then there's all these reports coming in on the old radios saying that it's like the rumors of war and some skirmishes that escalate, and one leader threatening another, and before they know it there's this huge war, and Christmas Eve or Christmas night all these bombers come in and destroy this little town. And And then it fast forwards a few decades, and people are basically, you know, living in the ruins, and they've become complete savages, and there are these gangs that, control the town, you know, with this gang leader. And then later on it emerges that there were some really smart, peace-loving scientists who survived the original war, and they all got together and gathered in some secret place and reinvented the airplane. And now they were flying around in these really funky airplanes to go to all these places to tell them that they had to join the World Federation, and that there would be everlasting peace. So eventually they do this, and they develop these underground civilizations so nobody has to go outside where it's all, you know.
Oh, it was supposed to be a nuclear war?
No, it wasn't actually nuclear, but for some reason, it's not clear that it was nuclear, but for some reason they just don't like to go outside anymore, I think.
Yeah.
And everyone gets really bored, and they just kind of sit around and have this sort of boringly idyllic life in this underground, you know, science fiction city. Some of the scientists get together and build a big spaceship because they realize that the human quest for adventure has to continue. But then this mob attacks the spaceship and tries to destroy it because they've decided technology is this evil thing that's made the world boring.
Oh my God!
Really,
I gotta get this
movie. Oh, it's totally cool. It's
The Shape of Things to Come. Yeah, Wells.
The Shape of Things to Come. Yeah.
Wells, you know, he's obviously he's one of the great visionaries of all time.
Wells was he was like a real World Federationist, right? You know, in the 30s, there were actually people who thought that they could, that there could be such a thing, a World Federation that would bring about peace and put an end to war. So it seems like a movie that would be right up your alley.
But he apparently, Wells, like Einstein and Freud, who also, they had this fascinating correspondence that was published as a little pamphlet called Why War? That came out, I think, in 1940. And both of them talked about, you know, can we solve this problem of warfare? And what's interesting was that they both sort of intellectually were optimistic. I mean, the whole point of the correspondence is to focus on this problem and come up with solutions. But emotionally, they were clearly very pessimistic, and with good reason. I mean, writing in the late, thinking about the end of war in the late 30s.
In
Europe was obviously a very difficult thing, especially.
Right, that's another amazing thing about this film. You watch it and you realize when it first came out in the theaters, World War II hadn't happened yet, and everyone was talking about World War I was so horrible, we can never let this happen again.
Yeah.
And yet other people were saying, oh, but, you know, there's not going to be a war, and if there is, it's good for the economy. And then, you know, 2 hours later, the whole town is just completely devastated, and everyone's bombed back to the Stone Age.
Hey, I hope this isn't too much of a discontinuity, but I was determined to mention, before this talk was over, that Carl Zimmer is coming to Stevens next Wednesday. This is Wednesday, September 17th, to give a talk. People can find out more about it on my on the website of the Center for Science Writings. And he'll be talking about his new book, Microcosm. And I know he's talked
book.
About it on Blogging Heads before. And it really is. You know, I actually just read through the whole thing and finished it about 2 weeks ago. And I just posted something on our blog. And what I said was that it really made me rethink my pessimism about the future of biology, at least pure biology.
Yeah, I read your blog post.
Yeah, and so I actually meant that. I mean, you know, I'm trying to convince people that Carl's written something important, but I really think he has. So the book is just about, sort of tells the story of modern research into E. coli, these bacteria that populate our gut, usually harmlessly, but sometimes they can, in mutant forms, they can become deadly. And E. coli have just turned out to be sort of the perfect guinea pig for scientists trying to understand heredity and mutation and even sex. It turns out that E. coli, under certain circumstances, reproduce sexually. Cooperation and conflict and evolution and the tension there.
Yeah.
And he has this one passage. Well, there are a couple of things that really struck me. In one case, he talks about how E. coli demonstrate the limits of genetic reductionism. So you have a whole population of clones, genetically identical E. coli, and yet you expose them to the same environment, and they will act in very different ways. So you put them in a nutrient bath, and one E. coli will be swimming all around very energetically, and another one will be a couch potato, just kind of sitting there. Some respond very aggressively to something that's toxic toward them. Others just sort of give up and die. So there's this.
But they're clones.
Pardon me? Yeah.
But they're clones in the same environment.
Right.
Yeah. That's amazing.
And so there's been this whole strain of genetic determinism in the science of human genetics over the past few decades. Actually, one thing that really struck me was Carl said that one of the scientists who discovered this range of behavior among genetically identical E. coli was Daniel Koshland, who was a microbiologist who was the editor of Science magazine from 85 to 95.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about Koshland was that he was on this whole bandwagon of using genetics to explain crime and all sorts of medical disorders and poverty. He thought that a lot of these problems that we've tried to see as social and environmental problems might actually have a strong genetic component. And he was sort of beating the drum for that and was really going overboard. I was very critical of him in some things that I wrote for Scientific American. And what's strange is that in his own work on E. coli, he showed that genetics is not all that predictive. So, and another thing that that Carl said that sort of got me thinking is that E. coli, in many respects, are still mysterious. So the ways that they, you know, they're extremely sensitive in detecting chemicals in their environment that might either be good or bad, and at navigating in relationship to good or bad stimuli. And scientists haven't been able to figure out how they do these things, even though they're so tiny and in some respects so simple. And Carl has this one passage where he concludes that instead of thinking of E. coli as sort of little machines whose parts you can just sort of understand, and then you understand how the whole thing works. He said each one is more like a little brain in itself.
Right, I remember that.
And I think that can apply to, you know, one E. coli is literally thousands of times smaller than the average brain cell, than the average neuron.
Yeah. And there's this huge amount of information processing going on. Yeah.
And so neuroscience.
Not just information processing, but also then actuating on the basis of the information. And yeah, it's incredible.
So I think, you know, I think I've said this in one of our previous chats, but I think some findings and recent findings in neuroscience suggest that that each neuron, instead of thinking of it as sort of a fairly simple switch or transistor, is more like a supercomputer in its own right, or if you want to say a mini brain, to use Carl's analogy. And it just suggests that the brain's complexity is orders of magnitude more difficult to unravel than we've believed previously.
Yeah,
I think that I feel that those are profound implications that came through quite clearly in this book. That's one reason why I loved reading it so much.
Yeah, well, that's good. I wish I were somewhere near Hoboken and I would drop by and hear the talk. Will it be webcast?
Yes, we will webcast it. Yes, thanks for reminding me. We'll my colleague Suha Sridhar will record it, and we'll throw it up there on the web for everybody to see.
Excellent.
So, all right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We've passed an hour here. I see 107:02.
So.
So I don't know. When are we going to do this again?
We'll have to talk to the Blogging Heads folks.
I assume have to talk
like
to the central
weeks.
Office. See
but
what
anyway.
They say. Yeah, you're going to talk to our friend Michael Brooks about his new book soon, right?
Yeah, well, sometime in November because he's not coming until mid-November.
Oh, he's going to actually be here in the
Yeah,
the
he's
That's
coming to
I
give a talk
that.
At Stevens. So sometime before then, I'll talk to him about his books. His book. 13 Things That Don't Make Sense. 13 Things That Don't Make Sense, yeah, which I'm really looking
forward
to.
Watch for it. It's a really cool book.
Yeah. All right, George.
Okay. Good talking to you. Watch out for those skunks.
Yeah, I will. You too.
I will.
I'll talk to you soon.